Okay, well, I'm Yoshiko Herrera, the director of PICA, the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. And it's my great pleasure today to introduce Danielle Lussier, our speaker. Today's talk is co-sponsored, we're very grateful, by the Center for Southeast Asian Studies, and that is a perfect fit for our speaker, Danielle Lussier, whose work spans these regions, and her work is equally on Indonesia as well as on Russia and other states of the former Soviet Union. Danielle is a 2011 Berkeley PhD, currently an assistant professor of political science at Grinnell College. And her work is broadly on political participation, political behavior in authoritarian regimes, hence the Indonesia-Russia connection, but with and also an emphasis on democratization. So looking at the kinds of political behavior and how that interacts with regime type. She has had work appear in Problems of Post-Communism, Soviet Affairs, and Slavic Review, so obviously publishing some of the Russia parts of her work earlier. But she's working on a book manuscript that analyzes the role of participation in regime change outcomes in post-Suharto Indonesia and in post-Soviet Russia. And she's also involved in a big survey project, I believe, survey project, right? Mm-hmm. On attitudes, social and political attitudes about Muslims and Christians around the world. So thank you, Danielle, for coming. And the title of the talk, as you can see, is Political Participation in Russia and Indonesia, Constraining Elites After the Transition.
Thank you. Thank you much, very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to have a chance to present this research, and I am going to be presenting data and an argument from the book manuscript that I'm currently working on. So since the 1970s, more than 60 countries have made transitions to democracy, and that's about a third of the countries in the world. As of the turn of the most recent century, 60% of the world's countries were democratic. However, as most of you know, not all countries that undergo a democratic transition continue on to build a surviving democracy. There are numerous examples of countries that successfully hold a single fair and free election, or maybe two fair and free elections, but then digress or regress back into a more authoritarian form of politics after a certain amount of time. According to the organization Freedom House, which provides an annual ranking of political openness in every country in the world, 2011 marks the sixth year of a consecutive downward trend in global freedom. So over the past 6 years, there's been less political freedom in the world than more, and that this is the longest setback in over 40 years since they've been tracking data on democracy outcomes. Now, two countries that exemplify sort of the trends that we can see in the world today on democracy are Russia and Indonesia. Both countries had transitions to democracy in the 1990s. Yet after several years of an open polity in Russia, Russia began to slowly regress back into a more authoritarian system. Yet in contrast, Indonesia has become one of the most thriving democracies in the developing world today. And moreover, these two countries are consistent with what political scientists know to matter for democracy's outcomes. They are outliers in our understandings of democracy. So what explains these outliers? In my current book project, I argue that Russia's failure and Indonesia's success at building democracy is a result of differing patterns in political participation that took place after regime change, after an initial transition to democracy. And I'm going to discuss these differing patterns in participation today, as well as one factor that I think contributes to their differences, and that's engagement in civil society. So to give you an overview of my lecture, first, I'm going to provide a basic description of the democratization experiences in Russia and Indonesia. I'm then going to summarize the primary findings from my research about the relationship between political participation and democracy. And then I'm going to talk about how patterns of political participation can actually serve to constrain or support democracy, giving a few specific examples from each country. Before going any further, I want to give you the conceptualization and the measurement of democracy that I'm using in this project. So democracy is defined here as the procedures that ensure competition for leadership positions through free, fair, and frequent elections, and the assurance of open debate about candidates and policies through freedoms of speech, media, and association. Now, most political scientists see democracies existing on some sort of a continuum. At one extreme, you have a completely open political system, and on the other extreme, you have a completely closed political system. And there are several indices out there that try to give different countries ratings of democracy using a variety of different indicators. One such organization is Freedom House, which provides annual rankings on political openness for every country in the world. And they accomplish this by using expert surveys. Now, according to the Freedom House scale, a score of 1 equals a completely open society, and a score of 7 equals a completely closed society. This chart here maps the Freedom House scores for Russia and Indonesia from the period of 1989 through 2011. And the trend is a rising upward trend. So things up in this quadrant mean more democracy, things down here means less democracy. So to give you some context to explain this figure, Russia falls into roughly 3 periods. First, political liberalization began in the late Soviet period with the introduction of competitive elections and loosening up on freedoms of speech and movement and association. This was followed by a period of political openness in the mid-1990s. This was the highest level of political openness that Russia experienced. Then starting in 1998, Russia started to regress slowly back into a more autocratic system, with a further decline beginning in 2004. And for the past 6 years, the level of political openness in Russia is equal to about what it was at the end of the Soviet era. Now, some examples of specific examples of authoritarian backsliding that we saw in Russia include adopting laws that have obstructed the development of opposition parties, raising the threshold that parties have to pass in order to enter the legislature in a way that favored the existing party in power, canceling gubernatorial elections, and the introduction of regulations that have severely impaired freedom of speech, media, and association. Now, in the 1990s, Indonesia was governed by the brutally repressive Suharto regime that had been in power since the mid-1960s following a failed coup attempt. Suharto resigned under public pressure in 1998, and that began Indonesia's initial ascent into democracy. Early reforms included liberalizing political competition, calling for new and regular elections, and protecting free speech, press, and association. Over the course of the next decade, Indonesia further deepened these democratic reforms and their implementation, including the introduction of direct elections for the presidency in 2004, reforms that decentralized and democratized administrative authority in the regions, and the elimination of an official role for the military in the legislature. So for the past 6 years, Indonesia has had a very steady politically open regime, and I want to point out that the level of political openness that Indonesia has achieved in the past half decade is higher than Russia ever achieved even at its high point of democracy. Now, our standard explanations for what correlates with a robust democracy don't really do a good job of explaining these two cases. So one of the primary argument that or factor that political scientists usually look at to explain political openness is the level of socioeconomic development. Okay? Now, Russia has a GDP per capita that's 4 times the size of Indonesia. It's a much richer country. A second factor that we think about when we think about difficulty to democratize has to do with the coherence of the state. Is there a strong sense of national unity? When there is, it's usually easier to develop a democratic system. When there isn't, it can be harder to get people to unify around that goal. Now, one indicator that we commonly look at to try to get a sense of that national unity is whether the national borders of the country are contested. Now, both Russia and Indonesia have experienced secessionist conflicts on their borders in the past 2 decades. A third factor that we often think about as impeding democracy has to do with the level of ethnic heterogeneity in a society. When a society is more divided, again, it can be difficult for them to rally around the goal of building democracy. Now, both Russia and Indonesia are ethnically heterogeneous societies. If anything, Indonesia is more heterogeneous than Russia. So these factors can't explain why Indonesia was successful at building democracy while Russia failed. So I argue, you know, if these factors can't explain it, what does? And my argument is that political participation constitutes an omitted variable that we're not thinking about when we think about what happens after transitions occur but before democracy has become consolidated. While scholars of democracy acknowledge that political participation is necessary for democracy, we have no agreement over how much is necessary, what kinds of political participation is necessary, what kind might actually hinder a democracy from developing over time. And in particular, we don't really have any good theories or arguments about when participation is important. You know, is there something that makes it more important immediately after transitions happen? So how does political participation influence democracy? So again, my definition, I'm using Joan Nelson's definition for political participation, which is action by private citizens intended to influence the actions or composition of national or local governments. In general, we think of political participation falling into two categories, contentious and conventional. Conventional participation is the kind of participation that works within the system to affect change. So examples of conventional participation are building and joining political parties, supporting campaigns, writing letters, or otherwise applying to public officials to receive constituent services. Contentious politics are inherently disruptive. They include activities that fall into contentious politics include lawful and peaceful demonstrations, acts of civil disobedience, but also riots. Okay? Now, while most research on political participation in democratizing regimes focuses on voting as the most common, most regular, and most important of political activity, my research actually focuses on non-voting political participation. So these other activities that people may or may not engage in. An underappreciated fact about the democratizing experience, or the democratization experience, is that it inherently opens up new opportunities for political participation to citizens. Now, which opportunities are open varies from case to case, but at a minimum, you're going to have two new arenas for expression open. The first is in forming and supporting political parties that would have been prohibited by the previous authoritarian regime. And the second would be using the avenues of free speech and freedom of association that have been expanded to write critical articles in the media or to hold peaceful protests. Expanding these new forms of participation between elections influences whether subsequent elections are also going to be fair, free, and competitive. Now, in particular, I argue that a key factor that influences democracy's survival is whether these new opportunities for political participation lead to a society adopting what I'm calling elite constraining forms of participation. These are activities that impede political elites from abusing democratic norms and institutions between elections. So examples of elite constraining activities include developing and supporting opposition parties. They also include airing criticism about sitting elites and engaging in forms of contentious politics. Now, the expansion of opportunities for political participation after transition facilitates these occasions for elite constraining participation in ways that would have been very dangerous prior to a transition. Okay, the opportunity cost of participating in a protest changes once peaceful protest is an accepted part of the political repertoire. The opportunity cost of supporting an opposition party or a candidate changes when there's actually a chance for that party or that candidate to have a role in the government. It becomes safe to engage in these activities, whereas before it was dangerous. So, for example, when citizens protest a decision made by a political elite, this draws public attention to whatever this particular elite did. It forces the leader to defend his position, but it also forces him to rethink whether or not he would take the same action again in the future, knowing that it would lead to such public outcry. It puts the leader on the defensive. It draws attention and forces him in a position where he's actually being his further actions are going to be looked at by the population and possibly this action might possibly be constrained by their participation. Now, if the dominant form of political activity that you see in a country is what I call elite enabling, it can actually help elites to maintain their existing power without actually strengthening democratic norms or institutions. So examples of elite enabling forms of participation include building and supporting hegemonic parties that are meant to support the existing power structure, or contacting public officials. So, for example, if a citizen appeals to a political leader to fix a pothole in the road, the political leader can fix the pothole, the citizen is satisfied, he or she may vote for that person in an election, but democracy is not necessarily the winner here. We have no idea how that pothole was fixed. Were illegal or corrupt means used to fix the pothole? It also becomes a private exchange, a private interaction between a political elite and the population. It doesn't lead to a conversation among the citizens in the town about how good this particular individual is about fixing potholes. It doesn't constrain him. It gives the elite a chance to continue to maintain public support while simultaneously manipulating democratic institutions to support his short-term goals or interests. This is what we see happening in Russia. Okay. Now, if elite constraining, I think elite constraining participation, it really needs to expand after a political transition, because every political elite has an interest in maintaining his or her power. So we need to think about what sorts of actions need to be supported so that it's in the elite's interest to maintain democratic institutions over time. Now the data, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the data and the methods that I'm using in constructing this argument. So I have three primary data sources. First, I look at 9 different public opinion surveys in both countries. And I use these surveys to look at trends in political participation in civil society within each country over time and between the two countries. My second data source were expert interviews. I interviewed in both Indonesia and Russia about 70 journalists, analysts, representatives of political parties, and representatives of mass organizations. And my third data source were a quota sample of interviews with citizens in 2 cities in each country. And the purpose of these interviews was to talk to people and gain sort of a political history of each individual, what their experiences were like under authoritarianism, democratization, and since transition, and to look at how patterns in political participation and engagement in civil society changed over time within specific individuals. I conducted my research primarily in 2 cities in each country, Kazan and Krasnoyarsk in Russia, and Surabaya and Medan in Indonesia, and I'm happy to talk more about this specific case selection in the Q&A. To give you a sense of where these cities are located, Kazan is in the lower Volga region. In Russia, it's the capital of an ethnic republic called Tatarstan. And Krasnoyarsk is in central Siberia. It's the capital of the largest region in central Siberia, which sort of covers this swath of land. In Indonesia, Surabaya is the capital of East Java. It's the largest city in the eastern part of the country. And Medan is the capital of North Sumatra. And Sumatra is the second most populated island in Indonesia after Java. This graph here charts participation in conventional and contentious activity in Russia and Indonesia over time using existing survey data. And what you see here is that Russian participation in both conventional and contentious activities peaked in the late Soviet period in 1990, and then started to decline over time. This decline over time actually predates Russia's regress into authoritarian politics. So it's not simply a consequence of it became harder to participate. This decline actually happened when opportunities for political participation were very open in Russia. In Indonesia, the first year for which I have data is 2001. Indeed, the data are more plentiful for Russia in terms of the survey data. But we see that the levels of conventional political activity in Indonesia are higher than they ever were in Russia. And more importantly, that they actually increase over time. And Indonesia's level of contentious political participation is higher than any period in Russia after the late Soviet period. Now, how did these figures map on to that graph that I showed you earlier? What you see here, this isn't the best pictorial image, but it's the best I could do. The black dotted lines are the bar graphs for Russia, and the green ones are for Indonesia. So again, just going back to this slide, Russia's high point in political participation is in 1990. You can see that this is as Russia is ascending to its democratic heights. The decline in participation happens here in the mid-1990s and continues over time. Indonesia's first point of political participation, for which I have data available, is this period here. So it's already pretty democratic, and it continues to become more democratic over time. Now, the information that I got from my citizen interviews confirms these trends and also adds some additional detail. So first I'm going to talk about the Russian data for my interviews, and then I'll talk a little bit about the Indonesian data. So I found in my interviews that Russian participation did indeed decline over time. I also found that the Russian youth were the least likely segment of the population, the least likely demographic group to engage in political participation. Half of my interview respondents who had engaged in some form of non-voting political activity had only engaged in this activity once. They didn't develop any habits of participation. The only non-voting participation that any of my respondents repeated was contacting public officials, which, I remind you, is what I'm calling an elite enabling form of activity. Once an individual had a positive response in having an issue addressed by a member of the political elite, he or she was more likely to repeat this activity. Yet even this most common form of participation had declined over time. In contrast, all of my Russian respondents who had engaged in a political campaign or who had participated in a political protest, forms of elite constraining activity, did so only once. They did not develop habits of participating. Moreover, all of the instances that I found of individuals engaging in either of these types of activities happened before the year 2000. So my interviews were conducted in 2008. So none of the 50 individuals that I interviewed, and admittedly I know that's a small sample, but none of them had engaged in any campaign work or protest work before the year 2000. Actually, I rephrase that, campaign work since the year 2000. I did have one person who protested in 2005. So in contrast, Indonesians, I found, really prefer these elite constraining forms of participation. They like to support political parties, and they really like to participate in demonstrations and street protests. Rather than peaking in the early period of transition, I found that Indonesians increased their participation after the political transition had actually occurred. So once an initial fair and free election had taken place, Indonesians had an interest in participating more. Students in particular, I found in Indonesia, engage in protests at very high levels. So one student activist that I interviewed reported engaging in protests multiple times a week. Another one who I interviewed, who would not consider himself an activist, but just a standard student, reported that he engaged in protest approximately 5 times a year. I found that in general, a broad cross-section of society in Indonesia participates in political activity. Whereas in Russia, it's very unusual, I found among my respondents, it was very unusual to find anyone who did not have a college degree participating in any form of political activity. Indonesians of a broad segment of society participate. In particular, people with less education become very heavily involved in party development work. Protesting does seem to be more segregated among students or labor union activists. The other difference that I found that I think is quite meaningful between these two countries is that in Indonesia, these elite constraining forms of participation are regularly repeated. Half of my Indonesian respondents who had engaged in some form of non-voting political participation had done so more times than he or she could count for me. The frequency of participation varied across the types of activities, with individuals who contacted public officials or protested engaging more frequently in that form of participation than those who did campaign and party work. Again, I think some of that has to do with the cycle of the fact that you get more involved in party work when there are elections, whereas protests can happen more, independent of the electoral cycle. Now, I want to point out that this idea about whether or not acts are repeated is something you're never going to capture in survey data. So survey data, when it asks about political participation, usually forms the question in one of two ways. Either have you ever engaged in a protest, or you know, have you ever contacted a public official? Or it asks you how many times in the past, or have you contacted this or engaged in this activity in the last 6 months or 5 years? It's very rare that you get a count. How many times have you contacted a public official? How many times have you protested? Yet, differences in whether or not activities are repeated can have really important system level effects. So for example, if an individual protests one time a year versus the same individual protesting five times a year, the average level of participation that happens in the society is going to differ. So for example, if we think about the Arab Spring that happened last year, if people had gone out and protested in Tahrir Square only one day, Mubarak probably would still be in power. It was the repetition of those protests over an extended period of time that compelled him to engage in this process of regime change. If we want to take the example of the recent protests in Russia and think about it here, we haven't seen any of them persist for more than one day. Even when you get a large turnout, it's not enough to, that the repetition of that act is not frequent enough to constrain elites in the current system. So to give you a sense of the causal argument that I'm trying to make, I assume that all political elites would like to maximize their power. I'm not saying they all want to be dictators, but I'm just saying, you know, even the president of the most democratic country in the world would like to have as much power as possible to govern efficiently. So when you have high levels of elite constraining participation, it's harder for elites to roll back democracy, and democracy survives over time. And this is the outcome that I see happening in Indonesia. When you have high levels of elite enabling participation, it's possible for elites to slowly roll back democratic gains between elections while continuing to serve constituents on very basic levels to maintain a certain level of support. And this is where you get some authoritarian reversal. And this is the outcome that I see in Russia. Now what I want to do is give you, the first part of my presentation, I gave you some data that makes this argument for why you get more elite constraining participation in Indonesia than in Russia. And now what I want to do is explain the arrow. So how does this lead to whether or not elites can roll back democracy? And I'll give you an example for each country. So first, my example for Indonesia has to do with the presidency of Abdurrahman Wahid, who was president of Indonesia from 1999 through the July 2001. He is most commonly known by his nickname Gus Dur. So Gus Dur became the Indonesian president after the 1999 elections. His party was the fourth largest party in Indonesia. And over the course of his presidency, Indonesia continued to prove extremely unstable. The period of time that led up to Suharto's resignation in 1998 was a period of great economic and social turmoil in Indonesia. And so by the time that Wahid came to power, there were many things that needed to be addressed. And Indonesians were very concerned that he was not doing his job the way that he should be. A little over a year into his presidency, legislators expressed continued frustration with him. They claimed he was allowing economic reforms to languish, was exacerbating regional political tensions and social conflicts, and generally providing weak and incompetent leadership. Above all, legislators resented his refusal to acknowledge that the Indonesian House of Representatives was his constitutional equal. They asked him to step down and started to investigate two corruption charges against him. This tension continued over several months, and the actions of the legislators were supported by the public. In January 2001, protests calling for his resignation broke out in three cities in Indonesia, including a protest of 10,000 in Jakarta. This was the largest protest against Gus Dur since he took office in 1999. Yet, to counter these protests, starting in February, supporters of Gus Dur staged counter-protests against those who were protesting for his resignation. In particular, these counter-protests were calling on legislators to drop their corruption investigation and drop their proceedings that were ultimately going to lead to impeachment. So we had this from February through May, we had this push and pull of protests and counter-protests going on across Indonesia. And ultimately, as Gus Dur's support within the government dissolved, in July, he issued an emergency decree, which included the suspension of the legislature and all of the activities of the primary political party that had been pushing for his removal. Yet, the military and the police ignore this decree. He's impeached, removed from power, and peacefully leaves office. In this example, we see how political participation constrained elites. Protests against Gus Dur empowered the legislators to continue to move forward investigating corruption, continue to move forward with impeachment proceedings. And ultimately, those protests also empowered the military and the police to refuse to implement the state of emergency that he announced when he still had the constitutional power of the presidency. Yet at the same time, these counter-protests that were in favor of him also served to constrain the legislators to act in accordance with the Constitution and not use extra constitutional measures to try to remove Gus Dur from power. Ultimately, this conflict ended up being resolved with adherence to democratic norms and institutions and provided for democracy's survival. As a counterexample to this, I want to talk about the experience around the cancellation of gubernatorial elections in Russia. In 2004, President Putin canceled elections for Russia's governors. Russian governors had been popularly elected since the early 1990s. This decision was passively accepted by the population, even though, as the poll that I show here, 48% of the Russian population disagreed or strongly disagreed with this action. There were no public protests against this decision, and no major criticism levied against it. So I wanted to talk about this particular instance when I was interviewing Russian citizens. So I first asked them, in theoretical terms, about gubernatorial elections. I asked a question, in your opinion, should regional executives and legislators be elected by the people or appointed by the president? Of the 36 interviews in which I discussed this topic, 26 of my respondents favored election, to 4 who favored appointment. Yet when I specifically then said, well, what is your opinion about the 2004 decision taken by President Putin to cancel gubernatorial elections, I tended to receive one of two responses. One was, well, Putin's a smart man. He might know better who to appoint than I would know who to elect. And this is the sentiment that's expressed in the quotes that I have on the slide. It is good if they, governors, are elected by the people, but people do not always know who is good to vote for. Then this was correct. Putin knows who to appoint. A second response that I heard was, well, you know, it really doesn't make a difference because our governor is the same anyway. And indeed, Putin appointed, most of the governors that Putin initially appointed had been popularly elected. So for these citizens, all they cared about was that the same person was in office. The fact that the procedure by which one obtains that office had changed was irrelevant to them. Only one person that I interviewed came out to say that Putin's cancellation of the elections was wrong, and one other one was, you know, a little annoyed by it. The point here, though, is that this blatant action in which the level of democracy in the system was reduced, which went against the theoretical preferences of a large number of Russians, went by without any form of counter-participation to try to change it. No protests, no political action. This is an example of how participation failed to constrain a specific elite decision to roll back democracy. So this raises the question of what explains these patterns of elite enabling versus elite constraining participation. Why do you get some forms of activity in one type of country and a different set of activities in another country? Well, in my research, I'm exploring three factors that feed into that. And that's engagement in civil society, feelings of political efficacy, and political trust. In the remainder of my talk today, I'm going to talk about one of those factors, and that's engagement of civil society, although I'm happy to answer questions about the others as well. So I'm defining civil society as the autonomous intermediary stratum of society that exists between the household and the state. There's a long literature in political science that views civil society as beneficial to democracy through the development of norms of participation and habits of participation. But the mechanism that actually connects this sort of engagement in autonomous organizations to the outcome of democracy, it's often underspecified. And what I'm actually trying to do is suggest a mechanism, and that it's that high levels of engagement in civil society facilitate elite constraining political participation. So again, just to give you a picture of the causal argument I'm making, the level of engagement in civil society influences the type of political participation you'll get in a country, which will influence whether or not democracy survives. Now, a more stylized picture of that, you've seen the second half of this already. But I'm saying here that if engagement in civil society is high, elite constraining participation is going to be high. Whereas if engagement in civil society is low, elite constraining participation is going to be low. And now I'm going to talk about this relationship here. So first I'd like to talk about how I'm measuring civil society. The first measure I'm going to show you comes from the World Value Survey, which is the largest cross-national survey we have that asks about individual engagement. It's been conducted over five successive waves since 1981 on all inhabited continents. The data I have here from the most recent wave, which was from 2005 through 2008, and includes about 50 countries. Now, individuals who participated in the World Value Survey were asked, are you a member of this type of organization, and given a list of eight different types of organizations. So I used these data to calculate two statistics. First, I calculated the average membership level in all countries in the World Value Survey. And that variable ranges from a low of 0.15 in Jordan to a high of 5.58 in India, with a global average of 1.73. So if we just take the 71,000 respondents in the World Value Survey and average up the number of memberships that they have in associations, you get 1.73. Now, the number for Russia is 0.77, which is below that mean. So the average Russian belongs to fewer than one organization. The average Indonesian belongs to 2.55, so 2.5 organizations on average for an Indonesian. The second statistic that I calculate was the percentage in each country who belong to at least one organization. So the percentage of all respondents in the World Value Survey who belong to at least one organization is 63%. Indonesians, on average, are about 20 percentage points higher than that. Almost 84% of Indonesians belong to at least one organization. And Russians, by contrast, are significantly lower than the mean. On average, only about 36% of Russians belong to at least one organization. Now, another factor that's often related to civil society, it's a similar concept but not exactly the same, is social capital. And social capital is generally thought of to be more generally a non-monetary form of resource. It's a non-monetary resource that can facilitate interaction and generate resources that we can use for power and influence. And I tried to look at social capital by creating a measure of sociability. And what this is here is an index I created of questions that were asked in the fourth wave of the World Value Survey. And this question asked, how frequently do you spend time, and then it gives you four different groups, spend time with friends, colleagues from work, individuals from a recreational sports or service organization, and individuals from your religious organization. And so I took the answers to these questions, and I created an index from 0 to 1 and gave a score to every single respondent in the World Value Survey. So an individual who has a score of 0 is somebody, you know, it's your stereotypical hermit. He or she never leaves the house, doesn't get along with anybody. Someone with a score of 1 is your stereotypical social butterfly. This is the sort of person who on Wednesday night, you know, grabs a movie with friends, Thursday night, plays some basketball, Friday, happy hour with, you know, your colleagues from work, and then over the weekend grabs, you know, a meal with people who go to the same church or religious group with them. So I then used the numbers I gave to each individual to come up with country level averages. And what I really love about this statistic is that Russia and Indonesia actually constitute the empirical endpoints for the 63 countries for which I have data. So on one end, Russians of the score of 0.30 are considered to be the least social group in the World Value Survey. And Indonesians with a score of 0.79 are the most social group in the World Value Survey. I similarly tried to gauge the level of social interaction and the frequency with which individuals engaged in civil society organizations among my interview respondents, and the results generally confirm these trends. I found that, on the whole, Indonesians are both more sociable than Russians and belong to more organizations than Russians. Additionally, I find that these two different phenomena are correlated in both countries. People who are more sociable tend to belong to more organizations, but the volume of that is much greater in Indonesia than it is in Russia. Now I want to talk a little bit about the types of organizations that Russians and Indonesians tend to belong to. They tend to join very different types of groups. The most common type of organization I found among my Russian interview respondents that they tended to join was a sports or recreational club. In contrast, Indonesians tend to have very high rates of participation in religious groups, neighborhood organizations, and student organizations. So in Indonesia, the most common form of civil society engagement is in a religious group. About 85% of Indonesians are Muslims, and most of the Indonesian Muslims with whom I interviewed participated in a pengajian, which is an Islamic prayer group, Quran study group. And similarly, I found that Indonesian Christians, on the whole, tended to also belong to either a Bible study or a prayer group. So following their Muslim neighbors, they tended to gather at least once or twice a week to engage in their own religious study or activity that was separate from formal Sunday services. I also found in general that neighborhood organizations in Indonesia were very high, and this was a relatively rare type of organization I found in Russia. And third, I found that Indonesian students are very active in student groups. In particular, Indonesia has a very strong tradition of intercampus student organizations. So not just organizations that are located on a specific university campus, but national level organizations for which there are campus affiliates and for which there are very hotly contested elections for leadership positions of these organizations across campuses. And I also found that student groups in Indonesia tend to serve as a bridge between the university community and neighborhood organizations. And this provides this really interesting mechanism where students actually go into neighborhoods and mobilize non-students to become involved in political activity. In general, I found that Russians don't tend to hold this to the same trend of student activism, which is, again, a cross-national trend. Students tend to be very active, very social people. And I found that Russian students tended to not follow this trend. To the extent that they were involved in activities, they were usually not activities that were part of the campus. They might belong to, a yoga club that is in the town but isn't part of their campus community. I also found that Indonesians have a very high level of structured community activities that are not necessarily formal organizations. So the two most common examples of this are arisan, which is the Indonesian word for rotating credit organizations, and gotong royong, which is an Indonesian term usually translated into English as mutual aid or reciprocity. But my respondents had a very specific meaning to this term. They would say, oh, we do gotong royong every Sunday, by which they meant every Sunday we get together with our neighbors and pick up the garbage and just kind of clean up the neighborhood a little bit and engage in some sort of basic beautification projects. And these activities serve not only an economic function in Indonesian neighborhoods, but they serve a social function as well. I found that arisan continued to exist at higher levels of income, so families who didn't necessarily need to participate in a rotating credit organization because they made enough money to put their money in a bank and get loans still had arisan because they liked the opportunity to get together with their neighbors and share stories and such. Now, what I thought was particularly interesting about this parallel with the gotong royong is that, as any of you who know about Soviet social experiences, was that in the Soviet Union, you had an analogous sort of situation, the subotnik, where people got together and cleaned up yards and public spaces before major holidays. And I found that, at least in the cities where I conducted research, the Subotnik has not survived the post-Soviet era. Now, one approach that links civil society to political participation in long-standing democracies is the civic volunteerism model. The civic volunteerism model posits that citizens become active in politics when they have a motivation to participate, when they have the resources to participate in terms of time, money, and skills, and when they have networks through which they're going to be recruited to participate. This model, in my opinion, provides us with a transmission mechanism for understanding how the structure of civil society in Indonesia facilitates high levels of political participation in that country, whereas the structure of civil society in Russia doesn't serve that same purpose of helping to facilitate political participation. The organization of civil society in Indonesia helps individuals activate the resources of time, money, and skills due to the norms and structures of voluntary organizations. In particular, Indonesian civil society, I find, is marked by three very specific resources: the norm of volunteer labor, the norm of autonomous financing or charitable giving, and leadership training. And I found that Russian civil society, on the whole, lacks analogous structures, and that this is one of the reasons why it's been harder for civil society to mobilize into political participation in Russia. So I'm going to quickly go through those three resources. First, volunteerism. I found, on the whole, that Indonesians volunteer an enormous amount of their time for any sort of cause. So one example, a typical Indonesian respondent of mine, 35-year-old woman with a high school degree, spends an average of 10 hours a week on volunteer activities for about 5 or 6 different organizations. The volunteer tasks she engages in range from setting up the local polling station before voting day to coordinating the bulk purchase of rice for women in her neighborhood. What this resource trans into is free labor for political parties. Indonesians who are used to just volunteering for activities, non-political ones, are more likely to give their time over to political causes as well. If you speak to any Russian trying to mobilize political platform, they find that getting volunteer labor is a particularly hard thing to do. And I just, you know, I have this beautiful propaganda poster from the Soviet Union on here. I just love it because it asks the question, you know, have you signed up as a volunteer with this, you know, raging fire in the background? And that's a very threatening poster. Why would you sign up to be a volunteer if, you know, that's what you're being asked to do? Now, the second norm is this norm of autonomous self-financing. And I found that, on the whole, Indonesians were quite comfortable with parting with small sums of money for some sort of collective purpose. One example of this, I think it's a great example, came from one of my respondents who's a small food vendor. He owns a tiny little stall on the side of the road. He doesn't even have a house. He sleeps on a bench in the stall. And he belongs to a small merchants association of all of the other little vendors in that area. They pay the equivalent of $1.50 into a pool every month, and it's a social insurance fund. So if there's a fire and somebody's stall burns down, they get the money. If they don't have an extreme need for it, people can use that social insurance fund as a form of microfinance to go and buy some piece of equipment to improve their food stall. And what he said to me is, this has indeed become an association that's serious. Without it, we small traders could not get by. What I found was that Indonesians' habit of being willing to part with small sums of money for collective good translates actually into some financing for political parties. Indonesia's a much poorer country than Russia. Yet not once did I hear a political party or a mass volunteer organization complain about financing difficulties in Indonesia. Yet this is a very common complaint in Russia. I found that among Indonesian political parties, individuals who are elected to the legislature at any level make an informal agreement with the party to pay a percentage of their salary over to the party to redistribute it to other areas. This is something I've never seen in Russia. Now, a third norm in the civil society that we see in Indonesia that we don't see in Russia is a structure for leadership training. All of the major mass organizations, namely the two largest Islamic organizations, have procedures for, if you join them, to rise through the ranks and receive leadership training to actually carry out activities at higher levels. So this is an example, a picture and a quote here from an Indonesian Students Association. That talks about, you know, anyone can join the association, but it takes a particular person to become a leader. And we train those leaders to take on other activities. Well, I found, for example, that two of the Islamic parties in Indonesia, most of the leaders of that party had gained leadership training through the non-political leadership training programs that they had gone through. And you can see how this could happen at a very low level. Let's say you're part of your Quranic study group, and you're asked to bring in a guest speaker. You know, the skills that have to go into organizing that speaker, creating the audience, et cetera, could easily be deployed for a small campaign activity as well. What this does is it levels the playing field. It gives a chance for people from lower socioeconomic brackets to gain skills that are normally reserved for people who are either employed in the formal sector or have higher access to higher education. I found in general there wasn't a leadership structure in Russia in the post-Komsomol era. Now the last point I want to just make is that another issue that is relevant here are these networks for recruitment. There's a pretty robust study in American politics, the initial study that looked at the civic volunteerism model, that found that if you ask people to participate in politics, they're likely to say yes. The question is, who's going to ask them? Now, if you have a dense network of civil society, if 80% of the people in your country belong to at least one organization, and you're the most social population on earth, the chances of running into somebody who's going to ask you to support a candidate or participate in a protest or write a letter is much greater than if you're part of the society that doesn't belong to any organizations and spends time alone in their kitchens. Okay? So the networks for recruitment are just much higher in Indonesia than they are in Russia. So again, just a reminder of my stylized causal scheme that I gave you. When engagement in civil society is high, you're likely to get elite constraining participation. It makes it harder for elites to roll back democracy, and democracy survives. When engagement in civil society is low, elite constraining participation is low. It's easier for elites to manipulate nascent democratic institutions, and you get authoritarian reversal. So just a quick summary and conclusion. Following a democratic transition, high levels of engagement in civil society contribute to democracy's survival by facilitating an expansion of elite constraining political participation. When elite constraining participation dominates in a society, it's harder for elites to manipulate new democratic institutions, thereby increasing the likelihood that fair and free elections are going to continue into the future. Elites learn that they serve at the pleasure of the people. When elite enabling participation dominates, however, there's limited collective action to hold elites accountable. It's easier for elites to respond to individual constituent needs while simultaneously hollowing out the types of institutions that are meant to constrain them. Again, in the specific cases of Russia and Indonesia, the structure of Indonesian civil society equipped individuals with the capacity to engage in elite constraining participation and help further democratization. The absence of similar norms in Russia limited the expansion of political participation and made it easier for the elites to roll back democratic institutions in the country. Now, a few implications from my findings. One is that factors that contribute to political transition may be different from those that contribute to survival. In particular, I think civil society and political participation are variables that matter more after transitions taken place than before them. And that's something that that political scientists need to spend a little bit more time thinking about. Second, the relationship between socioeconomic structures and democracy is more nuanced than a lot of our theories or our empirical models tend to account for. You know, education and income are thought to be this great modernizing force that increase the likelihood of democracy holding over time, but they're only relevant if the educated population becomes politically active. Russia's this example of this highly educated population that doesn't use those skills to deploy them for political participation. And I also want to point out that the types of organizations matter. When we think about civil society, we often think, well, it's just really important that people are engaging in collective action and that they're interacting with each other. But I actually think the types of organizations matter here, not their content, but rather whether or not engaging in them gives individuals the opportunity to build and transfer and practice civic skills. Sports organizations aren't as likely to do that as neighborhood organizations or religious organizations. And I think, again, this is really important when we think about religious organizations, particularly in the Islamic world. As we all know, there's a deficit of democracy in countries that are predominantly Muslim. But my case of Indonesia shows that it's precisely these activities that happen in Islamic religious organizations that helped to give Indonesians the political skills that they needed to participate effectively once democratic institutions were introduced. That's it for me, and I look forward to your questions and comments. Thank you. Yes?
It's really wonderful work that you've done here, and for somebody who was raised, educated in a completely different world 50 years ago, essentially the same ideas were out there, but the vocabulary was different. And there were many sources like William White's Street Corner Society, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, or Seymour Martin's Lipset's work on bowling leagues. And I mean, this whole kind of participation thing was very much being studied. And one great source for this is Democracy in America, the book, volume two, where he talks about the science of association. The Russian thing, having lived a little bit in Russia, I would ask two questions. One, I'd like you just to say something about the Ukraine and how and perhaps differing results are coming out, if you know anything at all about the ground level in the Ukraine. But the other thing that just ran through my mind, that by God, the Russians, I think, had a lot of participation sort of forced on them for a long time. And what was private really was became precious. And get me away from it all attitude is very prevalent. And Russians love to party, and they love friendships. They may not like to go out and do constructive things together. There is that spirit, though. But I think there's a lot of reaction in the average Russian against a long period of totalitarian organization. That's one thought, and it may be different than Indonesia in a way. And then another thing is that the Russian Orthodox Church, I think, with all its mysteriousness and hierarchy and stuff, and the reaffirmation of its monopoly on organization is putting a chill on Russian society. You can't, as a Protestant, organize a simple church. You can't open a bank account, for one thing. There's this religious law that which has essentially channeled all religious activity into either orthodoxy, or if you're a Buddhist or Muslim, you can operate over there, but you can't adopt these kind of Protestant activities, which are much more community participation oriented. I once saw a Boy Scout troop being organized in an Orthodox church, but I don't bet there's much of that there.
Great questions, comments. First, on this point about the totalitarian history and forced participation. So, of course, Russia, the Soviet Union, had this great history of mobilized participation, and that's, I would say, within this field, a very strong hypothesis for why you don't get lots of participation in Russia now. And I think that explains part of it, but not all of it. And let me explain why. I find Russians choose to get involved in contacting public officials. And that actually also has a sort of germ of history in the Soviet era. In the Soviet Union, public appeals to lower-level Communist Party officials were encouraged as a way to monitor how the party was behaving. In fact, my absolute favorite story from my interviewees was I met a woman who, in Krasnoyarsk, whose husband had been an officer in the Soviet Army. And when the war in Afghanistan broke out, her husband was deployed there, and she was left without any housing. And she was forced to move in with her mother and grandmother into a one-room apartment with two kids. And she appealed to all levels of the military bureaucracy and didn't get anything. So she wrote a letter to Brezhnev and said, dear General Secretary, if the Soviet Army cannot provide me with an apartment, then please send my husband back from Afghanistan so he can work and get me an apartment. 2 weeks later, bureaucracy shows up at her door, gives her two apartment. Okay? So this legacy, I don't want to say legacy, but this history of appeals that people are voluntarily doing, no one's forcing them to do that, that persists, and people continue to engage in that activity. So the question is sort of, not that they don't want to participate in politics at all, but the channels that they're choosing to participate in. The other reaction I have, too, to this, is that when I look at the demographic groups that are participating, If anything, we would think those who had a longer experience where they'd had that forced participation on them, they'd be the ones least likely to participate. They're actually the group that participates more. It's the youth that has been socialized primarily in the post-Soviet era that's not participating. So I think that there's an element of truth to that. I think that there are more recent dynamics that are playing out as well. Now, your comment about the Orthodox Church, I think, is very interesting. In fact, the role of religion in this was a variable that popped up for me very much in the very late stages of my study, and that wasn't something I had initially walked into looking at. But I have a plan to actually work on this in the future, because I really do think there's something about whether or not the structure of religious organizations provides for community leadership or not. And I actually plan to look at comparing Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, and Muslim organizations and sort of seeing how that works. Yoey.
I'm wondering about how you see things changing over time, because, I mean, the first set of comments sort of gets at that a little bit, but I would say since last year, civil society in Russia seems to have changed, this propensity to protest, the participation of youth, and with the evidence you presented on Indonesia, in terms of habits, so there's activities that you do, but if you have a habit of giving, a habit of going to different organizations, I'm just wondering how that connects with the Suharto era, or how these kinds of civil society activities and habits, how quickly do they change if there's a regime change, or how do you explain the protests since December 11th? I mean, December of 2011, you must have thought quite a bit about this.
I have. So I do think that one of the challenges of looking at these cases and trying to do this research is that clearly Russia has been more authoritarian in the past 6 years. And so the levels of civil society that one can measure in year 2008 or levels of political participation that one can measure in year 2008 is clearly affected by the fact that it's harder to do these things now than it used to be. Now, I do think that, yes, in December, we saw a protest of 50,000 people in Moscow. The last time in Russia had a protest of that size was in 1991. I mean, this has the potential to be a game-changing thing. But what's really interesting is that, and one could argue that it has changed the game a little bit. I think it has in two ways. One being that prior to the protests that broke out immediately after the Duma elections, prior to that, as many of you are probably aware of this group, there's this group in Russia called Strategy 31. And every month that has 31 days, the Article 31 of the Russian Constitution is freedom of assembly. And every month that has 31 days, on the 31st day, they protest this. And they started this last year. And at first, they weren't getting permits to even hold these protests. They were completely illegal. Then they were getting permits for them. But there was always something ugly that would happen. People would be arrested for allegedly, you know, for something really minor, like jaywalking or allegedly resisting arrest. There were major arrests that took place December 31st, 2010. Boris Nemtsov was one of the people arrested for allegedly, you know, resisting arrest when it was very clear he wasn't trying to do that. Okay, that stopped after this protest of 50,000. Those protests have been able to go on relatively peacefully with relatively little police interference. That protest of 50,000 in December actually showed up on Russian state television. So there was some slight opening, I think, in the tolerance for freedom of speech and freedom of association and freedom of association that we've seen since then. Putin realized, okay, I've gone a little bit too far. Okay. But this still raises the question of, well, what next? And I think I'm not very encouraged in the short term, because the people who are out on the streets protesting aren't the same people who are trying to form opposition or successfully forming opposition parties. I mean, there's one party that's tried to register and failed to register. So I think right now the issue is that the system's closed so much that you would need the level that one would need to engage in to actually have meaningful systemic change is maybe greater than the resources are available for right now. Whereas the level that we have now might have been sufficient to sustain a system that hadn't closed so much. So that's one thought. And the question about habits and how quickly they change, I do think that these habits of charitable giving and volunteer labor and et cetera were they were prevalent in, during Suharto. They were not. This is not a new phenomenon in Indonesia. So there is something about that historical experience. But what's different is that the political system opened. So whereas before, people could organize for non-political community issues like rotating credit associations or cleaning up the neighborhood, now the arena where they are allowed to participate and not be sanctioned is greater, and they're deploying the resources in that way. Yes?
So my family's from Russia. We came here during the Soviet period. And as a young person, I found my entire family scolded me of, why are you wasting time volunteering? Mm-hmm. As somebody who grew up here, of course you volunteer and you, you know, do something helpful. But I was wondering if you would consider comparing immigrant volunteer behavior, because I would bet that it's consistent despite the fact that the system is much more open.
That's a great idea. I've never thought about looking at that, but I would be really curious to see that.
Because I'm guessing that you're going to see a lot of the same attitudes, or if you don't, they've been here for at least a full generation.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm really interested to hear the differences in attitudes towards volunteerism in Russia versus Indonesia. Under Suharto, as you know, there was a lot of enforced volunteerism, forced community activity, but one thing I was so striking there was that wasn't the big complaint when I was there under authoritarianism. People were mainly chafing under the shackles of freedom of speech and assembly. They weren't chafing under forced activities. Suharto had all these charities you were supposed to give to, and there were these little taxes, and I never heard people really complaining about that, although I thought it was kind of annoying there that everywhere you went, you knew there was this little box you were supposed to put money in, and you knew it wasn't going to any charity. Mm-hmm. So I find that sort of interesting that people are still giving money at the same rates that they used to, because their corruption is still just as high, if not worse. And now there's also zakat in the mosques, and that's now enforced, which is where you have to give a little bit of money every time you go to the mosque, and there's a lot of corruption there, and it's being abused. So it's interesting to me to suddenly think that the attitude remains the same, and it wasn't that big a reaction beforehand that I know of, and then now it's people continue. But one thing I think is interesting, you said that Indonesia's the most social people in the world, they have the most social people in the world, and you probably know the statistics that they're also third highest in number of Facebook users, and I think second or third highest in number of Twitter users, and Jakarta is considered the social media capital of the world now by some people in the industry. And so I was wondering about Russia, and there's something that people are organizing through Facebook a lot in Indonesia to engage in civic protests and civic activities, and they're connected, and they're you know, this is a huge trend. But and it's hard to say chicken and egg, but I'm wondering in Russia if there's the same excitement over social media, if that's becoming a factor, if people are beginning to feel somehow the incentives for engaging in all these things, of course, a lot of them are social. Being part of a network of friends, that it gives you an excuse, like you said, picking up garbage gives you an excuse to hang out with people. And I hadn't really made the connection before, well, all these connections, but I was wondering if anybody could talk about how social media might be used in Russia in the same way or different ways.
Well, I don't think you would have seen that protest, that 50,000-person protest in Moscow in December, something, a headline that didn't get picked up as much, but there were protests that first weekend after that December elections in 60 cities across Russia. And you would have never seen that in the era prior to social media. I mean, Russians are, I don't know the statistics, I don't know if anyone knows them, but they're very heavy consumers of it, not only of Facebook, but they have their own version of it, Kontakt, that they use. There's also this other site, Odnoklassniki, which is, you know, connects people from their, you know, your elementary through high school group where you can reconnect with them. And they're very into they use LiveJournal, which is no longer really used in the United States, but it's a very big deal in Russia, and there's bloggers all over the place. I think it is serving that connection. But the question is whether or not it's used just for social reasons, or it can be used for political reasons as well. And I think that really this past year is where we've seen that trend for it being used for more political reasons in Russia. In that respect, you know, I do think there's optimism for change, if for no other reason than the fact that it's easier to mobilize people. And
the incentives may change.
And the incentives may change as well.
You mentioned